The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 5, our series for health professions educators. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblind, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Kurzhanovskaya. On today's episode, we have a great discussion on educator essentials or basics for early clinician educators with Dr. Elizabeth Gatewood. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Of course, Molly. We are the Health Professions Education Podcast for all things teaching related. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. And we have a great conversation with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Gatewood. And we cover so many things, it's hard to choose, but best practices, tips for setting up the learning climate, how to optimize the process and the content of learning.
Amazing. Yes, we thought this would be a great episode to put out early in the academic year. Lots of new educators out there and lots of seasoned educators hoping to get new skills and improve their teaching. So I think you will learn a lot. Elizabeth Gatewood, DNP, FNP, CNE, FAANP, is the Assistant Dean of Education, Technology, and Innovation and a clinical professor in the School of Nursing at UCSF. She has worked to improve student experience and engagement in utilizing technology. She is currently engaged in multiple initiatives using artificial intelligence. In addition, she is particularly committed to equity. She's been the PI on multiple grants and received multiple teaching awards. Her current faculty practice is at the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, and the safety net for San Francisco's underserved populations, where she provides full-scope family care.
And we're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content and you haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource.
So without further ado,
let's get to it.
Dr. Elizabeth Gatewood, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to sit down and talk about educator essentials and basics for new educators. Before we jump into that, are you okay if we call you Liz for this recording?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Well, we'd like to ask just some basic questions just to get to know you a little bit better. Could you share a one-liner to describe yourself?
I'm a mid-40s newbie podcastee. Maybe I get to call myself that after today. Clinical professor, family nurse practitioner, runner, sailor, and mom to two littles, ages 3 and 5.
Aww. Amazing. Do you bring the littles on the boat?
Yeah, they go on the boat since 5 weeks.
Wow. Cool. Did you say since 5 weeks? Since five weeks old? Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, I love how you snuck sailor in there. Does that make you a sea woman or a sea,
I can be a sea woman.
One of my friends is also married to a sailor / sea man, and we're trying to figure out what the female version of that is. It sounds like it's not sea woman is what I'm hearing from context
calling
clues.
Ourselves captain, because usually we have to be like, you know, crew, but I think as women, we should just name that and we get to be the captains from now.
Love.
Forward.
I like it. Love that. Well, Liz, do you mind sharing, maybe it's sailor themed, captain themed, but is there a book, movie, show, or album that you've recently enjoyed that you want to share with our audience?
So it's so not sea oriented. I guess it's water oriented, but my go-to for decompressing is bad murder shows or books. Mm. So I recently found Ludwig on BritBox for those BritBox fans, and immediately ran out of episodes after like a couple weeks. So now I'm on to Death in Paradise, which is terrible. Think like Murder, She Wrote meets I don't even know what.
Whoa.
Okay.
If you want a Netflix Italian detective show, there's the Law According to Lydia Poet, which is, she's apparently the first female lawyer, but at those times, the lawyers were really detectives, and it was a really well done show. I mean, you have to be okay with subtitles, but it is of the murder detective vibe.
Love it. I'll take that into consideration and add it to my list. Thank you.
Of course.
And do you have a favorite piece of advice that you like to give, or a piece of advice that you've received over your career that's been really valuable for you?
I think the one that I like to give and has been valuable is sort of remembering your why. Because I find as a clinician and as an educator, there's really hard times. And so remembering why you're doing it and what a privilege it is to do it sort of grounds me in that, okay, this is just a hard moment and this is my essential and my why, and brings me back.
I love that. Speaking of like whys and kind of things that maybe like, why did this happen or why did this not happen? Do you have a favorite failure that you can think of, Liz, and maybe what you learned from it?
Yeah. I don't know that it's like a favorite failure, but it's definitely like one that I definitely learned from and was great. And I think two come to mind, and they're sort of correlated. One is night shifts. So when I graduated from nursing school, like way over 20 years ago, you had to do night shifts when you're a new grad. It was just the way it was. And I only made it 8 months. And I was like, I cannot do this. I couldn't function. And co-related, I also was training for the New York City Marathon. And I finished it. But the failure was that I was like 2 hours over my time, totally bonked, totally like felt depleted, and didn't train well from it, largely because of the night shifts and because I was, you know, in my 20s thinking I could do whatever. So I think that what I learned from it is that you can't just power through things. And I also learned that you need to sort of reflect and figure out, why am I doing this job? Is this best for me and my patients? And sort of regroup when you need to regroup, and that regrouping isn't always a failure.
I love that. Yeah. Do you still run marathons?
Half. With my two littles, I try and do at least one half a year.
Amazing.
Great. Oh my gosh, I was imagining they were like on you. Like there's like the two littles and you're like, one's on the front, one's in the back. And you're like, I'm just going to do these 13 miles. Yeah, exactly.
We just got rid of the double stroller, which I feel like is like a milestone.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, we'll jump into a case from our fictional hospital, Cashlack Memorial. We have Jane. She's a seasoned clinician at Rural Cashlack, and this hospital has just started hosting learners to rotate through their hospitals and clinics. Jane feels really confident in her clinical work with patients, but she's nervous about how to approach integrating learners into her patient care. And she wonders how to ensure that learners gain as much as possible from the experience. So, Liz, to start us off, considering when you first started teaching in a clinical setting, what surprised you the most about what you could or couldn't control?
Yeah, I think the thing that surprised me the most was the variability of the learners, and that you don't get to really pick who you get, right? The program or the faculty just send you somebody and you know very little about them, or at least when I started precepting, you knew very little about them when they came. And it's sort of on you to really get to know them and figure out what they need. And one program, you might get a learner who's like at this level and amazing and helps you with your time management. And then the next year you get somebody who's like really struggling. And that variability was really hard because you can't control it and you don't really know what you're going to get until they show up.
Oh my gosh, totally. Liz, I feel like you've just said the words that like resonate for millions of educators across the world, probably, if not the nation. And when we think about Jane in this situation, who really has been clinical her whole entire life and her whole job, you know, career so far, I wonder, how do you think about the challenges as Jane is thinking, like, I'm about to become an educator and a clinician. How do I kind of approach that in the most, I don't know, authentic way? What are the challenges that are potentially standing in my way?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges is that we don't really get taught how to teach in clinic or in our hospital or wherever we are, right? Most health professions education or health professions programs that are training clinicians, education might be secondary, like a minor or an additional degree, but really we don't have foundational training in clinical teaching. And so then we tend to just go, what did I like when I was in school? What didn't I like? How can I incorporate those? So I think that's a huge challenge. And then time management, right? So you had just finally maybe gotten your time management as a clinician down, and now you have a student or a resident with you, and how do you manage that and still stay productive? And then I often find too, depending on where you are, there's variable integration with the program or curriculum. So not knowing where they are maybe in their curriculum, or not knowing the specific curriculum, since there's so much variability across like med schools and nursing schools and other things like that.
Those are huge. Thank you for pointing those out. Yeah, I think when I started as a clinician educator, I felt very underprepared. And that was part of what inspired us to start this podcast. So hopefully we are sharing some of the best practices.
Yay.
As Jane's approaching her new role as an educator, what are some of the main aspects in clinical teaching that she actually can control in her day-to-day work with learners?
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to focus on. So one of the things is really just getting to know the learner and the program. So, I mean, she can ask the faculty, can you send me the curriculum? Where is this learner in their curriculum? What have they been struggling with before? Where are they thriving? And then the climate of the clinic, right? While there's some things she can't control, like how many patients or how crazy it is or how stressed the MEA is, there are a lot of things that she can control and she can support and be that buffer for the student.
And Liz, when you're thinking about the climate, because I think that's like a huge piece that we have, we'll say, some intentionality towards and control over, how does Jane actually shape that climate so that, you know, the learner feels that there's some psychological safety, that there's also room for that kind of autonomy and growth and maybe making mistakes? How can she like practically do that piece?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that she can control. One is even having some pre-written information about the rotation or the site that grounds or orients the learner even before they show up on site. And then small things like giving a tour, showing where the bathroom is, the water fountain, like these things that we don't think about because we're in the setting all the time. And then really calling it out, saying, you know, there's stressful things that are going to happen. Microaggressions might occur. I'm here. I'm with you. This is the reality of clinic, and I want to help us work through them and deal with them. So trying to create an alliance with the learner.
Liz, can I just tell you, I love that. Sorry, Molly. I saw you breathe. I apologize. Yeah, but one thing I love to do with we have Pisces students or kind of students who in their third year of clerkship spend their year mostly outpatient with us is to take the students on like a people tour and have them like really see like eyeball to eyeball, like who are the patient, who are the people who are on the other end of that, like apex message or epic message you send to schedule a patient. Like, this is the person who's going to be doing that for you and who's part of our team. And this is the nurse who's going to do, you know, the inhaler teaching or the Sublocade, you know, first gen long acting bup injection. Like, these, like, putting kind of faces to names, especially names when we're interacting so much on the EMR that, like, you know who you're actually talking to when maybe you're messaging a pool of people. I think that allows a learner to be like, oh, I am part of a team, and this is how the health system works, maybe not always so well, but like in its best ideal format, like these are the people who are involved. So I really love that you're kind of calling that out as like not just the structural where is the bathroom, but who are the people.
Yes, I love that. At our huddle, we make sure to go around and do introductions, particularly if there's a new learner. And I think that's key for making them feeling included because they're often forgotten.
And to go back to that that written document that you share ahead of time, we've had a number of guests sort of go back and forth about if they want to really include a lot of detail in that, or sometimes that feels overwhelming to learners and they feel like sometimes it's better to just kind of say it in person because then it has the tone that can't always be included on paper. What do you actually like to include on your rotations?
I usually include sort of the basics. I work at our safety net at in San Francisco. And so I sort of orient them to, these are the types of patients we see. These are the people that will be here. This is sort of our hours and our expectations. And then I also usually do have them come in a little early, like 15 to 20 minutes early, so that we can check in and go over the goals again. I do ask them to send me their goals ahead of time so that we can sort of go back and forth about those and then revisit them day of when we're in person.
And how do you make an effort to get to know the person? I mean, you sort of mentioned getting to know them clinically and their skills, but do you also have some favorite questions that you like to ask of just kind of, you know, breaking the ice, getting to know people for who they are?
Such a good question. I don't think I have a standard go-to icebreaker, but I usually will ask them, you know, what are you going to do on your summer break? Or what did you do over the weekend, to try and sort of get insight into their more personal day-to-day. And then I ask them specifically a lot about their experience so far, like what has been challenging in previous clinical sites? How can I support you through this rotation? What has worked well? What hasn't? And all those things as well.
And Liz, I love that you talked about goals. We have an episode on goals too. So, yeah. You know, not to plug that, but wanted to kind of get a sense for you when you think about, like, there's goals for the learner, of course, that both you have and you're asking the learner to kind of create, but there's also goals that you have for your own learning experience or like the learning environment and what you want that to feel like, what you want that to be like. And Jane is like just starting out and she may not, you know exactly what that vision is, but do you have a sense for yourself, like, what does that successful learning environment that has the climate as part of it, but how does that feel to you even when there may be kind of really stressful days?
I think that sort of for me, a successful learning day is when we sit down and do the feedback, then tie it to the goals. So when I first started out, I was not good about goals and setting them, and we would just sort of assume that the learner's goals were to be a better clinician, right? And so now I'm very conscious about trying to set sort of, my learners are with me for about 10 weeks. So I set long-term goals for the 10 weeks, but then I set daily micro goals for that day. And those allow me at the end of the day to say, you know, how did you feel today went? Get the learner's input and feelings. And then I tie it back to the goals. Like, so one of the things you told me today was that you really wanted to see this new patient with diabetes. You saw them. How'd it go? You know, do you feel like you met that goal? So really that loop is what feels really good to me.
I love that, getting them to commit ahead of time and you sending it to you on email, because then you have it so you're not going to forget it. And also it actually forces them to make the goal ahead of time and be ready with it. Because I think a lot of times I show up at the beginning of clinic and they're trying to pre-chart and I'm trying to pre-chart and they're like, well, I'm just efficiency. And I'm like, okay. And that's not really a goal that we can effectively meet in a clinic session.
Yeah, totally.
And one thing I will say is that feedback piece that you did at the end of the day, I love that, Liz, for us. And I think, Molly, you do this too. But with the students, they have to actually have like posted feedback, like BeBots or whatever, brief something, observation tool. I now have forgotten. Yeah. Bridges. And basically, I tell them when I'm doing that feedback, like, this is something that you can submit as a BeBot around note writing, around whatever, you know, goal or kind of territory that we just talked about, so that it's like, to Molly's point, it's written down somewhere. It's like, it's kind of immortalized in a way that we had this feedback and we talked about it.
Yeah, I love that. And I will say, you know, as a mom of two little, sometimes I need to run out of clinic for child pickup, and I will commit then to finding a time with the learner to make sure we like still do the feedback, even if it's not that same day.
Amazing. So Jane has taken your advice. She's reached out to the learner ahead of time. She's met them a little bit early. They set expectations. They've gotten to know the clinic, started to build that climate to be successful for learning. What are some ways that Jane can actually influence the process of learning without completely overhauling how she cares for patients or works in the clinic?
Yeah, I think pushing the learners to sort of improve their clinical reasoning or clinical diagnostic thinking. Lots of times it's really just easy to give them the answer, but pausing and sort of seeing where they are, one, can help the learner grow as a clinician, right? But also help the educator figure out where the learner is in the process. So I do like to use the 1-minute preceptor model. I don't use all 5 of the steps every time, but I do try and use the first 3. And then I kind of think of 4 at 5 at the end of the day. So I will really push the learner to say, so what do you think is going on? Or if they're an early learner, be like, so what physical exam do you need to do? Or basic things like that. So really pushing them to try and self-reflect rather than just defaulting to, well, this is what this is and here's what we're going to do.
And we do have a whole episode on precepting models. So if listeners want to dive deeper in that, it's available. But Liz, I think it would be great if we could just spend a minute or two of, if you could just kind of outline what the 1-minute preceptor is and how you use those first 3 steps primarily.
Yeah. So the 1-minute preceptor is a 5-step model. I think it was developed in the 90s, but you guys might have to fact check me on that. But that's probably what you do on podcasts, right? And the first step is really just getting a commitment from them. And that's really, so really causing us to pause and say, like, what do you think is going on? What do you think is happening? You know, where are you in your thought process? And then really thinking about why, step 2. So why are they thinking this? And that's really where you're getting your clinical reasoning and everything like that. And then step 3 is doing some teaching. So filling in those gaps, like what can you add to their knowledge base? And so I think of this not only as clinical, but also sort of thinking of patient-centeredness, So in this, like thinking of patient equity, you're like, is that realistic, right, for this patient population? So thinking beyond those. And then steps 4 and 5 are really feedback. So step 4, I think the original model said like correcting mistakes, but I try not to think of correcting mistakes and think of providing modifiable feedback or what they could improve on. And then step 5 is reinforcing what they did well, right? Because they need to know what they should keep doing. Otherwise, they're just going to sort of wander along, assuming that they're doing well.
And Liz, in those steps, like 1 through 3, we often think about like kind of how do we diagnose the learner or like think about where they're at relative to your key points, which were you're like, I'm trying to expand this person's clinical reasoning and how they approach, you know, solving and addressing patient concerns. How do you do that piece practically? Like, how would you advise Jane, who maybe is hearing about the 1 minute preceptor for the first time, but does have to get a sense kind of of where her learner is at in this exact moment? How might you give her kind of advice on that?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is really getting to know your learner. So, right, so we already had our meeting and we set the climate and everyone's feeling comfortable. So you know their background and sort of also know their goals. And then once you ask those questions, figuring out where the learner's fumbling, right? So if they even can't come up with any idea, then I try and say, okay, is this a knowledge deficit? Is this something environmental that's going on that they're so stressed out because their mom's sick in the hospital? Is this that they didn't do a good job getting history? But like trying to diagnose what's going on in the learner and why they're struggling. So taking a step back and pushing a little further to figure out where that issue is and then moving forward again to help figure out what the plan is and how you can support them.
And Liz, are you asking like certain reflective questions of the learner in that moment or, you know, like kind of getting trying to get them to be curious about their own process? Or how are you, you know, if taking out of the context of this being you advising Jane, but if you were with that learner who may be having a deficit, like how would you actually ask to probe that deficit maybe?
Totally. So I might probe saying like, did you consider any other diagnoses? And then if they're really struggling, I'll say, you know, one way that I think of it is thinking of one system up, one system down. Here are some other frameworks that you can utilize. And then now that we have these frameworks, are there any other diagnoses that you can think of? And so then pushing them to say, well, what if it was cardiac? What could you come up with? And usually then they can come up with some things. And again, if it's something else that's outside that's impacting their stress or something else, then they'll still struggle through all this. And we can step back and say, sounds like this isn't a great time. What do we need to do to make you in a good place where you can actually learn?
Yeah, I think that that is really tough, Liz, and for a lot of people, especially who's starting this off new. So for you to like demystify this, that like this is possible, you can do it too, you know, and I think a lot of things that Molly and I have been trying to do, I think on this season in particular of our podcast is getting folks or listeners to realize there's so much parallel and kind of similar processes happening when you're a clinician talking to a patient and kind of reasoning through a problem and when you're an educator and you're working with a learner and you're kind of trying to, you know, be a better educator for that person. And I think the 1 minute preceptor, it's like thinking about how you do this with patients, like how you communicate with patients and how you kind of ask questions very similar to what educators can do with their learners. And I think like helping Jane understand that, even though she might be really anxious and really nervous that this is possible. I wonder, are there any like other verbiage that we haven't said yet that might help Jane see these crucial moments as like really a teachable moment and maybe some verbiage that you love to use, Liz, in your teaching to kind of help get a sense of what's going on with that process of learning for the learner?
I like to think of quality over quantity. I think as an early preceptor, I was just like, okay, the student has to see this many students and this many patients per half session. And realizing that, okay, this does take process, but going through this process is going to help them more in the long term than having them see a whole bunch of patients. And then the other thing I like to think of is everyone gets overwhelmed by, well, a lot of people I talk to get overwhelmed by the fact that there's 5 steps in the OMP. And they're like, I can't do 5 steps every time when this person sees a patient, right? And I'm like, just do like 1 or 2 and then save 4 and 5 for the end of the day or whenever you have your plan to debrief and focus on like that clinical reasoning piece. And even if you're not teaching, do step 1 and 2, right? So thinking that you don't have to do everything every single time and breaking it down and realizing that like ultimately you're benefiting the learner by really pushing them to improve their clinical reasoning rather than see a whole bunch of patients really fast.
Great advice. And bringing it to that debrief again, what does a meaningful debrief really look like?
So I like to use, I think it's Dr. Calvin Choi from UCSF, who really taught me when I was an early learner about the art of feedback and trying to really push them to learn to reflect on their day. So when I ask, when we're debriefing, I say, what went well today? And inevitably they go to all the bad things that happened. Like, oh, I missed this diagnosis. I forgot to order this lab. I screwed up this prescription. And I'm like, no, step back. What went well? And I really push them to figure out what they did well, whether or not it's like, well, one of my goals was to do a PEDS well child check. And I did that. And I feel like I really connected with the family. And I can be like, I agree. I think you did a great job connecting with that family. So I try and reflect back and empathize. And then I try and build on it. So usually they can only come up with like one good thing. So I'll try and come up with a few more that they really like shined with. And then like, what do you want to improve on? Or what can we work towards for future? And really pulling that out of them as well. So for me, those are the sort of key things that lead to a successful debrief.
Liz, I love that because I feel like, not to plug yet another episode, but we had an amazing episode on kind of the anti-deficit framework and approach. And I feel like the fact that you are emphasizing and kind of re-emphasizing like what went well, and then not just like from the learner's perspective, but what did I observe that was a success, like a true win, you know, both maybe from an educational perspective, but also from a clinical perspective, and really highlighting that for the learner first, I think does set a particular tone that's like, even though I know just maybe a couple minutes ago we were talking about deficits, that like, you know, the actual front and center thing is these successes and the wins and the like positive, really the calling out of the strengths in this situation. So I really love how you, you know, name that first and really hone in on it.
Totally. And I'm not sure, I think it's Dr. Aronson's and some other folks' research on stereotype threat. I'm a big believer that stereotype threat exists and it like really impacts our learners in the clinical environment in particular. And so I really try and focus on like, here's where you are. We're going to get you here. And I really believe in you. Like really reiterating that you think that they can achieve this. I feel like makes a big difference.
Aw. I'm having like a whole like moment.
That is amazing for thinking about kind of the process of learning in the moment. I think in clinic, it can sometimes be very overwhelming because you don't really know what cases are going to come in and kind of what diagnoses are going to come up. How do you really think about the content to focus on?
Great question. I usually go through, so I'm an outpatient family practice, so I'm not having to deal with emergency room crisis as much, but usually I'll sort of have a check-in with the patient, we'll look at our list, and half the times that's what we see, and half the times they no-show, we see urgent care, you know, it's really flexible. And I try and focus that this is real life, right? So how can I help this learner? So oftentimes what will end up happening is if we get someone thrown into our schedule, I'm like, I can teach this person how to chart prep really fast, right? And that's what I'm going to focus on. Instead of what we thought we were focusing on, which was maybe chronic care, diabetes management, we're going to focus on, okay, this person just dropped in my schedule, so how can I help this learner? This is how you can really quickly chart prep. So I try and just sort of be flexible and pivot. And I think I sort of include that in my orientation of like, this is our clinic. We will have a schedule, but don't spend too much time chart prepping because it might change because this is our no-show rate, right? So, and one of the things you can gain from here is this pivoting as an opportunity. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of how I approach it if we don't, for the uncertainty of like clinical day.
And I think you said earlier, Liz, that sometimes you'll bring in like an equity question, like, can this person, you know, does this work for their life? You know, does this fit within what is possible? And I wonder, do you name that with the learner and say, hey, let's just do a quick equity timeout, or let's just do a quick focus on patient communication, or kind of like how the, maybe not just like what's the pathophys of this entity, or kind of how does, you know, the GLP really work, you know, but like outside of those, how do you maybe talk about some of these really like super important, but sometimes harder to really make it tangible, you know?
I love that idea of an equity timeout. I've never done that. And I think I don't do a good job of labeling that. I just sort of incorporate it into my teaching. So for example, if we have a patient who's in the shelter, you know, our default is to prescribe 90 days of medications. But if they're at high risk of losing it, I'll, you know, say to the learner, we should check in with this patient and see if they want 30 days or 90 days. Don't assume, but check in with them and see what's better for them. Maybe they don't want three bottles of metformin that they're lugging around in their backpack because they have to leave the shelter every day. So trying to just like incorporate those ideas into it. And then access. So access is a big issue in the safety network. And, you know, it can take, I don't even know how long it can take to get an MRI, sadly. But it can take a while. And so having those explicit conversations about where they're getting their care and how this impacts the outcomes and what this means for their life. So I try and have those conversations.
I think those are huge. And it's, I felt like personally as an early educator that I was supposed to be really focusing on the clinical knowledge piece of it, which is obviously really important. But I appreciate that you called out kind of that management reasoning and teaching our learners to be able to function in the actual patient care world, and that those other skills are so important too. Say Jane's like a really enthusiastic educator, and she's, you know, we're seeing this patient and she's really big on diabetes and she has 100 pearls she wants to share about diabetes. How do you counsel early educators on sort of where to focus in, like how to narrow it down, and how much should they be covering, say, in an outpatient clinic?
I love that. I would say, first of all, enthusiasm is the best thing you can have as a preceptor and educator, because that's what learners want. Even if you're struggling, the enthusiasm will carry you forward. I wouldn't do more. I mean, I say 1 to 3 is my general, because after that, they're going to lose a lot of it. They can only retain so much. And then again, with my teaching stuff, I try and tie it to their goals. Like, what was their goal for the day and how can this improve them ultimately as a clinician?
I will also say, not to out myself as an early/enthusiastic person, but when I started precepting, I had to like rein myself in, because I think I missed the Liz's bullet point on 1 to 3. And after being like, I can't comment, like I would obviously let them present their entire presentation, but if I comment on every single problem and give a teaching pearl on every single problem for this patient, our head's going to explode and this person will never finish clinic, you know? And so it took, unfortunately, I feel for the learners that worked with me early, but it took a little while for me to say like, it's got to be like 1 point, like truly 1 point per patient. I mean, I love the 1 to 3. I think you're like, you know, like enabling my early educator side, Liz.
I know, but that's, maybe I'm enabling myself, but yeah.
No. But I mean, this is like very individual. So maybe other folks are much better about this, but I had to limit myself to like 1 pearl, because the minute I started adding, like it was kind of like an addiction. The minute I started adding one, I was like, I crave another. And so then I would like add another pearl. So I think, you know, letting people like Jane know that this really is like, your enthusiasm is really important, but also like situational awareness that like this, you know, learner really may, as you said, just may not retain more, and figuring out like, what is that little nugget that I'm going to share? Like, is it going to be how a GLP works, or is it going to be like, this person realistically can only carry around 30 days of meds, you know? And like, that's what we need to know.
And I think the other thing that you bring up a great point is the time thing, right? Like, you don't have time to do 100 different points if you want the patient to be able to leave, right? They don't want to be here all day while you're teaching this learner 100 different things. So sometimes I also find that if you don't have time to teach, you can push the learner to try and do some of that work outside of the clinic, right? Like, oh, it seemed like you had a gap in GLP medications. Why don't you check that out and get back to me? But one thing that I have learned now, which I maybe didn't know as an early, is that you need to close that feedback loop. Like, learners won't initiate closing the feedback loop on whatever their in quotes homework was. And so if you give them a bunch of stuff outside because you feel like you don't have time to teach, you need to close that loop, or else they feel like you're giving them just like busy work, right?
That's a great point. And I think in terms of time management for the teacher, those are really helpful in terms of sort of being very upfront explicit about how your schedule runs and kind of what the expectations are in clinic. And I could see if you have a pretty strict schedule, you could say, you know, I expect you to see a patient for 30 minutes. And if you're not done, that's okay. And we'll finish the rest together. So being clear about what's needed, or if you can let them see somebody for an hour, then let them do that. And then also really narrowing in your teaching pearls. Do you have any other tips on how to fit teaching into clinic or into a hospital?
Well, I think what you just brought up is if you can let them see an hour versus if you need them to do 20 minutes is super important to call out in the beginning so that they know what to expect so that they don't feel like, oh no. But also, I mean, in outpatient clinic, I will often have them, if they're newer, spend an hour, hour and a half, and I'll see like two or three patients while they're seeing this one patient, right? So figuring out where that communication is, but also how can they reach you if they need you, if you're running around seeing all these other patients, right? Like, is it going to be the Epic chat? Are you going to use text? So really outlining in when you're setting the stage in the climate is like, how do you want them to communicate with you? What's the best way that they can reach you and feel supported?
I'm hearing a theme, which is around like expectation setting. And I do think it's both like for like the day, what our lives are going to look like, what our year rotation is going to look like, but also clinically, like what is the teaching, what is the educational experience going to look like? And I think letting as much as we can introduce like transparency for learners into that, because I think we have our own mindset of like, oh my God, this can only take 30 minutes. And then when it takes an hour, this may or may not be personally experienced this morning, but like when it takes an hour, being able to say, okay, like step back and be like, I had expectations. I don't think I made those at all transparent to the learner, or maybe I don't even know if I made them transparent to myself. But as much as we can set that, truly those expectations for both like, what, you know, what's your day going to look like in clinic, or what's your day going to look like in the hospital? What's the time for us to close the loop on the learning kind of topic that they're, going to like look into? And then also like, how are you going to find me if I'm seeing three patients and you have an hour to see this person? Like, I think that kernel of being transparent with that and what your expectations are, maybe isn't often recognized, I think, by educators.
I might have to take back my biggest failure, actually, now that we're having this discussion. I think my biggest failure was not setting up goals and expectations as an early educator, and then having a student who is really floundering and struggling and having to be like, hey, let's meet to give feedback. And then immediately, since I hadn't set up expectations of feedback, they know it's something bad happened or something, they're going to get bad news, right? And so now I'm pretty good about being like, we're going to do feedback every day so that if there is something that we need to course correct, it's not like a shock. They're expecting it. They know I do it with everybody. They're not the exception. And yeah, that's been huge game changer for me.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, I think these have been really great pearls. Any other main ones that you think we need to cover sort of around creating that climate or the process of teaching or what the content you're actually wanting to focus on is?
I don't think so. I guess last thing is remembering that even if you're not actively teaching, you're always modeling. So, you know, I try and really lean into consulting my colleagues in pharmacy and medicine and PT and like demonstrating how we can improve patient care through IP engagement for patients, and try not to, you know, get too overwhelmed and remembering that, you know, you're always role modeling, even if you're not actively teaching.
Liz, I love that, because I was going to ask to piggyback on Molly's question was like, for Jane, who's coming into this new identity as an educator in maybe a world where she was like, you know, a heavily clinician, that was her identity. What, you know, other advice you might have for her? And it sounds like the role modeling piece is key, especially around interprofessional kind of communication, teaching, learning, clinical care. Are there other things, especially as she kind of grows into this identity of an educator?
Yeah, seeking out community. We're so fortunate here at UCSF to have the Academy of Medical Educators and the Center for Faculty Educators. But that for me has been huge, just talking to other educators, listening to things like this podcast, seeking out resources, and knowing that you're not alone and that, you know, this is really impactful, and having someone you can reach out to when you are struggling.
Amazing. Do you have some main take-home points for our listeners?
I mean, I think my hopefully take-home point is that teaching is really fun and that you're creating a huge impact in the world. I always think like, I'm a provider, I'm creating change for my little patient panel and my families. But as an educator, you're then creating change for your learner and all the patients they're going to see. So really, like, by becoming an educator and leaning into the identity, the impact you have on the world is so much broader than just, not just, but then only being a clinician.
Thank you for bringing it back to the why.
Yes.
That was a full circle.
I was exactly, oh my gosh, Molly, mind meld. Liz, that was really inspiring. Do you have anything that you want to plug, like paper, resource, mentees, work, anything like that?
No, I would just say seek resources. You know, lots of times we take this on without realizing what our resources are, and there's tons out there. You know, there's apps. Most universities have resources for clinical educators. So really lean into it, seek it out, and yeah.
Own, amazing. Do you have any
amazing role of educator that you're embracing?
Do you have any open access things that come to mind as resources that you think we
totally
should link?
MedEd portal. I mean, that one is wonderful. Goes beyond clinical teaching. It also has didactic. There's an app that I can't think of right now, but I think it's called Just in Time Teaching that has a lot of resources as well. And then there's obviously like journals like the Medical Educator and things like that. And then, yeah, your podcast, right?
Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Liz. Appreciate it. This has been wonderful.
Yes. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. And thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoytwein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I'm Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska. Thank you for joining us today and for letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.